Hello, and welcome to another recording of the D&D Experience Seminars. The next seminar that we have up is the Beyond the RPG Seminar with Mike Merles, Rich Baker, and Chris Tulock. In this seminar, they will discuss the new Three Dragon Ante supplement, they will talk about Castle Ravenloft, and they will discuss the Gamma World game in detail. Before the seminar, we sat down with Rich Baker, who gave a very quick introduction to the Gamma World setting, what it entails, and where it came from.
This is Bart Carroll with Rich Baker. Rich, you are going to be presenting a seminar about the D&D game Beyond the RPG, and part of that is going to cover Gamma World. It's very exciting for folks that remembered that game back in the 80s. For folks who might not be familiar with it, can you give us a quick introduction of what Gamma World is?
Gamma World is... This is a game that a game setting that's been around almost as long as D&D. The first editions of the Gamma World appeared right around the time that the first edition Player's Handbook and DMG showed up. It is a science fantasy world. It is something sort of in between the Road Warrior and Star Wars and generally post-apocalyptic fiction. It's a mix of incredible high technology, powered armor, fusion rifles, people with just awesomely powerful mutations, weird, bizarre monsters, an America that's an entire world, really, that's been utterly destroyed and laid waste by radiation and mutagenic diseases and all sorts of stuff. It is essentially a role playing in a D&D style adventure in a futuristic post apocalyptic world.
Which sounds a little dark, but from what I'm gleaming, there is actually more of a fun, quirky element to it.
Absolutely, the setting is one that has always kind of lent itself to a certain amount of humor, because your characters often had powerful mutations and drawbacks of you know, crazy things like, sure, you might be able to shoot laser beams out of your eyes, but you suffer from narcolepsy and you might fall asleep in the middle of a fight. Or, hey, you have the ability to control the minds of others and make them fight as your puppet slaves, but you happen to have... no skeleton, so you have to be wheeled around in a cart by your friends, right? You might be a plant. You might be a mutated badger. I mean, it's just a bit wacky what sorts of things you could be. So in returning to the Gamma World now after a little ways away, a little time away from it, we wanted to make sure that we presented a game where a lot of these sorts of humorous touches were there, but it still was a pretty good, solid, you know, D&D-style game.
Great. Well, thanks for the primer, and looking forward to more of the details in the following seminar.
Great. My pleasure.
All right. So welcome, everybody. This is the Beyond the D&D RPG panel. We're just going to talk about some of the non-RPG D&D products we're going to be doing. Well, the Gamma World is an RPG. Yeah, so sort of things beyond the D&D role-playing game.
The core role-playing game.
Right? Yeah, exactly. So I guess we'll start with introductions. I'm Mike Merles. I'm lead designer on D&D. And with me is Rich Baker and Chris Tulock. Why don't you guys give intros? Why don't we start with Rich?
Hi, I'm Rich Baker. I've been with Wizards of the Coast /TSR since 1991. You might know me from recent products such as Manual of the Planes. Martial Power 2, which is coming out just next month, is something I love to design on. I'm also the lead designer of our upcoming Dark Sun setting, as well as our Gamma World game, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. And I've been around a while, so you've probably seen something that I worked on at some point or another.
Oh, and also, don't you have a novel?
Oh, yeah, that's true.
He's a busy guy.
You. Yeah. My novel, Avenger, which is the third book in my Blades of the Moonsea trilogy, is going to be out in March, and we actually have some examples here at the show. Mm-hmm. I'm doing a signing at 6 o'clock this evening in the main hall.
And I'm Chris Tulock. I'm the D&D Organized Play Content Developer at Wizards of the Coast. I've been at Wizards for a little over 3 years, 3 years. I'm in my fourth year, yeah. 3.5 years almost. And I do all the organized play content stuff. So like the Living Forgotten Realms games that are running here, Worldwide D&D Game Days. We have a new program, an in-store program called D&D Encounters that's starting on March 17th. All those things are things that go through me. So I work on all those programs. So any of that play type, the official D&D play type stuff goes through me.
So to kick things off, we are going to talk a little bit about Three Dragon Ante, Emperor's Gambit.
Yeah, which I've played a fair amount.
It's a standalone game. It's a card game. If you played through Three Dragon Ante, it's going to be very... it's a standalone game, but it can also be used as an expansion to the original Three Dragon Ante. So Chris, why don't you talk a bit about it?
Yeah, it's really kind of cool. So it's like Mike said, it's an expansion or a standalone. Some really interesting elements are they're using obviously more of the iconic dragons. You're looking at the other metallics, some of the other chromatic dragons, some of the ones that are new for fourth edition. Like you'll have like purple dragon and you'll have the adamantine. Yeah, the adamantine's in there, and there's a bunch of other really cool dragons are brought to the fore with that. It also has component of the game where you can actually mix and match the sets. So you can either play, like Mike said, as an expansion to the set, or you can play as a standalone. But you can also choose which kind of card types you want to use. Right. So if you want to use, let's say the seven from one set, or the green from one set, and the purple from the other set, they might be interchangeable. It's just an example. I don't know off the top of my head if they are, but the set plays really well. It's got some really interesting new mechanics. It's got some fun new mortal cards in it, and other creatures. So it's got things like I think there's a dragon turtle card in there, and there's a like a dragon wormling in there, wormling card, and they all have interesting new mechanics on them, and it's really, really fun. I've had a chance to play it a few times around the office, and I'm totally hooked on using it. So as soon as we can basically start running tournaments at our later shows or later cons, we're gonna throw the Emperor's Gambit expansion in the mix, because that's gonna make for a really fun time with tournaments, because you can kind of modify your play style based on the two different sets of cards. So
is it basically the same core mechanics, just with different cards in the deck with like different effects on those cards?
Right. Yeah. It's going to be you're going to get the same core mechanics. You don't have to worry about like the gameplay itself isn't going to change too much just from the basics of learning the game and playing through it. But what the cards do, what the individual cards do, completely. Some of them move in completely different directions. A lot of them play around with the anti-pool. A lot of them play around with there's some cards that play around with turn order and things like that. So it'd be really fun.
Do we have an anti-druid?
Because I gotta
tell you, the number of times that darn druid made me lose when I thought I was gonna win.
I don't think an anti-druid card has ever come up for me. But when I played it, I played with just the expansion.
Yeah.
So I haven't integrated the sets yet. And I'm really excited to try and do that. So I think when we do like our first tourney where we actually have the set available, we'll probably do rounds where you play with just the set, and then rounds where you mix them together and see what we can do.
So next up on our agenda is the Castle Ravenloft board game. This is going to be an August Gen Con release, and it is a cooperative D&D dungeon crawl board game. I think, especially in board games, I think every board game has, most board games have a sort of DNA of what board games came before them that they've sort of inherited from. So you can think of Castle Ravenloft as being a sort of combination of the old HeroQuest game, Descent, the Fantasy Flight big box game, and Space Hulk, and to some extent, Betrayal at House on the Hill. I think I'm getting that title right. It's really a game where one of the big ideas for it came. I was at a party last spring, and we're sitting around. It's a cookout. We're going to play some board games, and it occurred to me that everyone at this gathering was a D&D player, but there's no way we'd even consider trying to play D&D right now, because we have to sit down and make up characters, and someone at the DM and pull an adventure and figure out what they're going to run, and the setup takes so long. And then once we start playing, it's like 4 or 5 hours. But it seemed kind of funny that we have all these D&D fans together, and we don't have a D&D game to play. So that was one of the set inspirations for making this game, where it's focused on the playtime is about an hour to an hour and a half. It's cooperative, so you're playing against the game. Essentially, the game is an automated DM of sorts. There's a deck of event cards you draw from that spawn monsters, traps, and other hazards. It's based on Castle Ravenloft, so we literally went through the Castle Ravenloft first edition module and just pulled out NPCs and monsters and traps and rooms and converted those into event cards. If you've played Space Hulk, you know they have those modular templates of cardboard to build the interior of the spaceship you're fighting Gene Stealers in. This game uses 4x4 square templates with puzzle piece connectors to interlock. So you basically you build the dungeon as you go. I think there might be a scenario or two that have a pre-built dungeon, but most of them are as you're exploring, you're laying down tiles as you move through the dungeon. There's 5 different characters you can play. I think we have an Eladrin Wizard, a Dragonborn Fighter, Dwarf Cleric, Human Rogue, and a Ranger. The Half-Elf Ranger?
Half-Elf or an Elf?
Yeah, it's Half-Elf or an Elf Ranger. Yeah. And so it's very team-driven. Obviously, it's a cooperative game. And there are 13 different adventures you can play. And the adventures, essentially, if you can think of, it's very much the D&D board game in the sense of the core board game rules are almost like a very simplified RPG system, where everything's just sort of structured and put together, and then the scenario, the adventure you're playing, dictates what's actually going on in the board. So, for an example, you may be playing a scenario where you have to go into the crypts beneath Castle Ravenloft, find the holy icon of Ravenloft, the old holy symbol for the original adventure, and then escape back out of the dungeon with it. And that has a very different play style as compared to the scenario, which is go into the dungeon, find the Dracolich's lair, and defeat the Dracolich. Or the snare, which is, and I think this is one of the adventures, I can't remember off the top of my head if it made it to the final copy, but you've been captured by an evil hag and imprisoned in the dungeons beneath Castle Ravenloft, and now you're just trying to escape. So there's a lot of different ways we can take that core system and tinker with it to create a different adventure. So it's really focusing on replayability. It's very fast-paced. We aim for about an hour to hour and a half play time. A lot of the rules if you played 4th edition will be pretty very similar, that you're using D20 roll against an AC. And really a lot of the new rules just deal with how the board game creates, how it serves as a DM. Essentially, we have a very simplified artificial intelligence for each of the monsters. Monsters essentially come with a script. So when you take your turn, during each player's turn, you have two phases. You have your player's phase, where you get to move around your character and attack or explore. And then every player has to run Strahd's phase. And essentially, every event or monster card that you have personally drawn, you keep in a little pile next to your character. And on your Strahd's turn, you activate all those creatures. So if there's a zombie that you drew, there's a little script that'll tell you, okay, this is what the zombie does. It may say it moves adjacent to the nearest character and attacks him. Or it may say, if it can't see any characters, it moves, it tries to get out of the dungeon and runs to the exit or things like that. So it's essentially, it creates a DM that is spread across all the players, and that's just automated. You just go through and run the different cards and events you've drawn. And of course, as you're playing, you can defeat the monsters to remove those cards from play. You can disarm traps. There's also other sort of different card effects that come into play that you can try to get rid of and by taking specific actions. So it's really the kind of combination of that general system of this automated DM combined with the scenario that makes the adventure run. And it's fairly fast-paced. It's like a very, very cut-down D&D system where you have your character, you have your move action, attack action each round, and then you have a couple powers you can use on top of that. We also have a system for finding treasure as you overcome encounters. So as you play through a scenario, you find magic items you can use, and then obviously you're trying, usually some of the scenarios involve finding an artifact of some sort and doing something with it. So yeah, it's really steeped into the lore of Castle Ravenloft, really drew on that story. The scenarios themselves have a bit of a progression to them. If you wanted to just sit down and play the first scenario and go all the way to the 13th and final scenario where you fight Count Strahd. So it kind of mimics this sort of adventure campaign in Ravenloft. So we really wanted a game that can have that fast play element, but with those different scenarios, if you wanted to play for 4 or 5 hours, you could just play through 3 or 4 different adventures. And it's also, the difficulty level, it's meant, I can't remember the exact percentage. We sort of pegged the math of the game to make you lose at more than half the time when you're starting. So we also see part of the challenge of saying, well, how far can we get to this scenario before we're all overcome? So it was a blast to design, and I hope you guys like it. So
how many miniatures come with the mic?
There are 44 miniatures in the box, I believe.
42, 44. Yeah, one of those numbers.
It's a huge
42 would be really cool, but but I don't know. Yeah, it's one of those numbers. It's something in the 40s, yeah.
There's one for each. Now, they're unpainted, just keep in mind. When you're dealing with a board game, it is a board game. If you look at what, like, Fantasy Flight does, generally those games, if you're getting painted minis, you're getting six in a $60 game, not 42 or 44. So they are unpainted, but they do come in different colors of plastic for the heroes versus different types of monsters. And they are DDM sculpts, so they'll be sculpts you've seen before. Yeah, and there's a Dracolich is the huge that comes with it. There's five-player characters. And then there's sets of three of the typical monsters, like skeletons, zombies. And then there are also some sort of sub, like, minor villains that you'll get one miniature of. So yeah, we're pretty excited about it. There are 13 sheets of dungeon tiles. Those tiles include the modular game boards that you build as you explore the dungeon. And there's also tokens for things like treasure, or if you uncover a trap, there'll be a token for it that you can put down on the board to mark where it is and things like that. So yeah, we're pretty excited about it. It's been it's also a game that in November we're releasing another board game that uses the same system. And that one is called the Dungeons of Dragonfire Mountain, if I'm getting that right. We just got the title like last week. And that basically you can think of it like kind of like a role-playing game. It takes the same basic system, but provides new adventures and a few new mechanics to differentiate it. Because obviously, if you're playing House of Ravenloft, that's sort of gothic horror and undead. The second game is more high adventure, going into a dragon's lair and battling monsters there. So that'll might have some unique mechanics that tie into that. And so that is basically the long and short of it. If you've played... Oh, and Pandemic is another game that just off the top of my head. That kind of had definitely an influence on the design direction we took. So if you've played any of those games and enjoyed them, hopefully you'll like this game too.
Yeah, I think I played the Icon of Ravenloft scenario, the one where you try and get the Icon of Ravenloft. And that was really, really fun. I remember, you know, that there was just sort of this building, you know, this building, like, sense of panic as we explored further and further into the dungeon, because it became tougher and tougher and tougher as more and more monsters kind of piled on us, right? Yeah. And we're trying to fight our way, you know, through it to get to the icon and get out, right?
Yeah, and that's a good sort of like the archetypal scenario for the game, where so essentially, and on everyone's turn, you take your turn, then you draw a card for Count Strahd to see what he's doing. And a lot of those cards will stick around. Maybe a monster appears or something like that. And the game's difficulty, by regulating the number of cards you're drawing, we have a very easy way to throttle the difficulty. So in the scenario Chris played, as you're exploring the dungeon, you're just drawing one card on each player's turn. It's not that – it's manageable. If you're trying to kill monsters as soon as they appear, you can do it. As soon as you find the icon – and I believe it's a scenario, this is that scenario. Everyone starts drawing two cards. Mm-hmm. And you'll be surprised how much harder the game gets when you double everything you're facing.
Yeah.
You're hitting the point now where you can't kill all the monsters that show up. You're going to have to let some stick around and start mobbing around you and slowing you down.
Yeah, and that's kind of exactly what happened too. We kind of got to the icon without too much trouble. You know, we had some close run-ins in a couple of places, but we got there and I think everybody was okay. And then we got the icon, and then we're like, holy crap, this is really tough now. And we're all drawing cards, and we're like, I don't know if we're going to be able to get out of this, guys.
There's something about – and these are play tests, and I'm not sure because I worked a lot on the initial design of the game, and then Peter Lee took over the sort of finishing things. So I may mention cards that don't show up in the game. But there's a certain synchronicity that this game seems to have of you're going along fine, and then, okay, the fighter will pick up the icon, and then he'll move into a room – draw his card and all the the walls of the room have sealed shut. So now he's trapped in here and can't get to the exit. So now we have to free him. And then his next card is a ghost appears in the room and starts draining his life. And then there always seems to be this sequence of cards you hit at one point, which is the exact worst thing you could have happen. You know, like we're running toward the exit and then we just drew three straight monster cards and who show up at the exit and start moving toward us and we can't get around them. You know, things like that. So it's been a blast to design this game and play test it. So
Dungeons of Dragonfire Mountain is actually compatible with Castle Ravenloft to some extent. You could actually do extended scenarios that use pieces from both games.
Yeah, since it uses the same core scenario, like the monsters use the same – they might have different scripts for their AI. But the and what we're going to do for Dragonfire Mountain, that'll have its own scenarios. It'll be a separate game. You can buy either one, full rules. And then I think through DDI is where we'll do things like here's the mega scenario if you want to combine the two sets. more, because really it's all just about designing the adventure to use different monsters and a different subset of the cards.
Hi, this is Bart Carroll. I'm just going to interject in the middle of the podcast to repeat some of the questions that are not so clear on the audio. The audience had asked what the minimum number of players was. The answer was one. The next question coming in was, what is the age limit for the Castle Ravenloft board game?
So off the top of my head, I think someone 8 to 10, especially playing with other people, could pick it up pretty quickly. So,
yeah, with other people, pretty young. Gang of them, kids by themselves, probably 10-ish.
Yeah.
Seems about right.
The I believe some of the scenarios, if you want to play solo, I believe specific adventures will have, you can play this one solo as opposed to some of the more complicated ones, which you need more players for. But it does range from 1 to 5. Yeah, the nice thing about it is essentially the difficulty scales up by the number of players, because essentially it's you draw event cards. Strahd, his things come up based on the number of players. So if the player goes, then he draws a card. If you only have two players, you're only drawing two. Essentially for the entire go around the table, you're only drawing two cards for Strahd. So.
Yeah, the miniatures just by themselves is actually a pretty good deal.
Yeah.
With the price of the box, it's
$65.
$65.
Yeah. And it's a big, heavy box.
Yeah, it's a quality.
Just between the tiles and the miniatures.
Tiles and miniatures right there. Yeah. You know, if you don't run and grab it at Gen Con, it's cool. You can just go get it at your store, because we'll probably have some play going on in the Sagamore Ballroom, so you can at least play the. So instead of running, grabbing your copy and then carrying it around with you, you could just go to the store and get it. You could just come play it in the Sagamore and then experience the game and be like, oh, I totally want to get this. When you're at Gen Con, if you have a chance to come by the Sagamore, I'm sure we'll have copies.
We'll definitely have events, and
we'll have some Castle Ravenloft and stuff going on.
Maybe
there. Maybe Mike will be there. Yeah, who knows?
We'll see.
With Dragonfire Mountain, so you talked about the different themes. Is there something like a little hint you could give as to we talked about Castle Ravenloft being the gothic horror thing and Dragonfire Mountain being sort of the heroic fantasy. Is there something that you could give a hint for how that's going to maybe play?
I can't go too far because now Peter Lee is doing the design work. The development work for the first one. Now he's doing the design work, but I believe I've seen copies of the Dragon Mountain boxed mega adventure and what was the other one? I'm blanking on the name. I'm about to drop a spoiler. I'm like, Gates of Fire Storm Peak.
Flipping
through both of those for inspiration. So
awesome.
And that's something, as we move on, if we do a third or fourth one, you can expect us to take classic D&D adventures and really mine those. Oh, yeah. To get that experience.
Seems like a Tomb of Horrors would be inevitable for this.
Yes,
or Temple of Elemental Evil.
Temple of Evil, Caves of Chaos. Yeah, we got a long list.
You could do a whole bunch.
For the initial release, we wanted to have the preset characters because that makes the design of it a lot easier and helps us hit the sort of, hey, you can play this in an hour. But it's definitely something we've talked about. And I think it's really just going to depend on how much of a reaction we get to the games, if people are into them, if they like them. It's definitely, since it's more of a game system than just a very static board game, we've definitely thought about what are different ways we can expand this, support it through DDI and stuff. So
yeah, certainly DDI articles where we lay out, here's three new characters for your Castle Ravenloft game.
Mm-hmm.
Would be super easy to do and a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Right. In essence, a character is sort of like a designed game piece with its own stats and values.
Yeah.
Because that's the game experience you're trying to replicate.
Yeah. But it's definitely something we've talked about as we go forward. It'll really just depend on what kind of expansions we want to do for the game.
One more question coming in was, what other settings are possible to explore in these type of board games?
I think what you'll see is that there are definitely it isn't necessarily tied to the setting, but there are things you could look at, say, Dragonlance and say, well, we know that a lot of people out there like the Dragonlance novels. Is there a game that we can make that makes D&D role players who like Dragonlance at least happy in some way, but also gets people who maybe have only read the novels and don't really want to play a role-playing game, but might want a game that has something evocative and has something to do with Kryn? And that's a good example. If we did a game like that, we might say, okay, well, let's take the first novel and give you scenarios in the board game that replicate key scenes, fighting the Black Dragon and I forget the name of the Ruined City, but things like that where you can, okay, this really feels like we're playing through. Because there's one thing I think in RPGs, there's a lot of resistance, not resistance, but I think it kind of makes sense. RPGs are making your own stories and making your own world, where if you wanted to play through a classic D&D novel, people might not be as interested. They know how it turns out. But playing a board game, I think people are a little more open to doing things like that.
And this is not necessarily the only board game engine we intend to play around with. Obviously, we have a pretty solid one. with a very repeatable model to it. So that's kind of why Dragonfire Mountain, exists. But in the case of like a Dragonlance game, it's not at all crazy. We might look at that and say, you know, what people really want to play here is the War of the Lands. Let's design a big picture strategy game where you get to play something Risk-like or Axis and Allies-like at some point. It's possible. We have a lot of ideas like that rolling around. There are also other models for. We're all big fans of the European style board games, obviously. So the model that we are following here is definitely one theme, but there's many other things we could do. In essence, a lot of our board game strategy is taking a step back and saying, "Hey, we have this great intellectual property, the Dungeons and Dragons game, right? The idea of wizards and knights and rogues and elves and dwarves and all that. Right now, we have one great expression of that game that we routinely present to our fans, that being the RPG. A second one is the novels. What other sorts of experiences can we provide to people who are looking for? I mean, the novel's great because if I go on an airplane, I can play D&D by reading a novel, and I'm not going to bug anyone around me, and I've done something kind of it's a way to kind of keep up with what's going on, when I can't get anyone together, and that's the experience I want. Yeah.
That's why we're in the seminar, in fact.
Right.
is all about other expressions of the D&D game.
Right. So like the board games, as Mike says, it does fit a niche for, it's Saturday, it's rainy, the game got canceled. What are we going to do today? Heck, let's pull out the game. I know, or hey, Joe, the DM can't make it tonight. Well, damn it, Joe, this is game night. Don't you? DM can't come. But great, let's pull out Castle Ravenloft and play a game.
Yeah.
Or hey, we had six guys in the party, but three of them couldn't make it because they had to go do something else. Well, shoot, we can't finish this encounter at half strength.
Or your favorite, right? Where you kill half the party, and you're only like two or three encounters into your night, right? And you're going to be playing an 8-hour game session or something, and it's like, well, those guys could sit and generate characters and then sit around for a while, or they could just get a couple.
Or they might get up and go play
in.
The Xbox or something, right? But we want to give you an alternative to the Xbox, right?
Sure, break out Castle Ravenloft instead.
Next question came in regarding the comparisons between this style of board game and one such as HeroQuest.
I played HeroQuest a lot when it first came out, and we definitely thought of, like, what's a way we could do something that feels a bit like HeroQuest? The one thing, though, I think, especially for you guys and for our audience, is maybe a game that's got a little more depth to it, that has a little more so it doesn't quite have the sort of advancement of HeroQuest where, you're getting levels and items and stuff between scenarios, but we want it to feel like a that's where I think the sort of space hulk comparison comes in. We want people to feel like, hey, let's play this quest. We got eaten halfway through. Let's play it again and see how far we can make it. So it definitely has some inspired. HeroQuest was definitely an inspiration, but we didn't want to end up with a game that just felt like, well, it kind of feels like we're just playing D&D but with simpler rules. Like, we wanted to have that element of like the time pressure and that rising dread. It's close, but I think there's a few tweaks there that make it a bit different.
The auto DM card mechanic, I think, goes a real long way towards doing that. It's one of the real differences in what we've got as compared to that sort of experience before, right? Mm-hmm. Where, first of all, it vastly increases replayability because you can run the same scenario again, and if different cards come up, it's an entirely different experience.
There are a lot more cards than you'll use in a session.
Yeah,
they're in the box. There's like over 300 cards or something like that.
Yeah. I can't remember off the top of my head. It's a good size deck.
Yeah, and I know that the event deck is really big because I played with it and it's big.
Yeah, we intentionally made it. Yeah, exactly.
You play one or two scenarios, there's no way you're going through all those cards.
Yeah.
So you're going to see a lot of new stuff, And and by the time you actually make it through that whole deck, you're going to forget what some of the cards did. There's just so many of them. Yeah. Right.
And the combinations, like I mentioned before, you get these combos that just really hose you, and it's when we're playtesting it, it'd be kind of funny to think, I hate this stupid moaning skull, but I like it because I designed it, and I'm happy it's making me so angry because it should, because it's supposed to be really, it's supposed to. And these things would just come up, but there are a lot of times when just this weird combination cards would come up, and you're like, that just really hosed us, and how are we going to get out of it? So,
another question came in regarding the relationship of R&D with Avalon Hill in regards to these type of board games.
In essence, by the way, we are Avalon Hill, right? It's all the same R&D department, Wizards of the Coast R&D, right? Avalon Hill titles that have come out, like Betrayal at House on the Hill and the various Axis and Allies games we do, that is work that we essentially do in our in-house. In the case of the Axis and Allies titles, usually we're involving Larry Harris, the original creator of Axis and Allies, right? And we're working back and forth with him, and he lives out in Massachusetts somewhere. And but by and large, right, Avalon Hill is just an imprint for us that, you know, our marketing folks like, because it gives us an opportunity to kind of tell people this is the kind of experience you're going to get out of this box,
right?
But we're really it is a combined pool, and game stuff than even not in this particular board game Castle Ravenloft, but generally in the board game stuff, you see a lot of mixing between the two groups of R&D folks, that the card game guys and us.
Right.
We tend to collaborate on this sort of thing a lot more because it kind of falls sort of in between our normal fields of expertise. It's a great chance for us to cross the streams, you know, and work with the Magic guys, and the Magic guys work with us and stuff.
Yeah, and Rich, you've done work on some of the Avalon Hill A&A stuff, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You've been doing the Naval line, right? The Warren Sea stuff.
I was a principal designer on the Axis and Allies miniatures, the land game, and then on the naval miniatures, the Warren Sea game.
Right.
And in fact, I when I get back from the show, I get to work for a couple of weeks on a new Warren Sea set, which is just such a fun change of pace. I spend most of the year in wandering around in dungeons and fantasy landscapes, and then I get to.
Then you get to
totally change gears.
Then you get to play with boats, right? Yeah. That's what they call them, baby boats.
Old plastic boats. But you're in my office making little shooting noises with my mouth, you know.
And one more question regarding Castle Ravenloft and how it might interact with the 4th edition D&D mechanics.
I think it'll kind of depend on what we see, like what people ask us for. Right now, we kind of see them as separate game lines. The rules. They look a little bit like, if you could think of the D&D minis game as opposed to the RPG, where it uses a lot of the same concepts, but like the damage in, say, in the minis game, hit points and damage roll in multiples of five, things like that. So it's more of a slim down, like damage in this game is very low. Like I think characters have like 8 to 10 hit points to start with. Most monsters hit for like 2 or 3 points of damage, things like that, just to kind of keep it simplified. So I think it kind of just depends on what people see, you know, what kind of reaction we get. If we see a lot of people really interested in the game, that obviously would be something where we step back and say, well, maybe Ravenloft is something we should look into doing for the RPG because there's a lot of interest in it. It kind of ties back into that, how everything fits together. You know, talking about if we did a Dragonlance board game, how would that look compared to what we, you know, what maybe if people in the Dragonlance more into the novels and RPG and things like that. So it would really kind of depend on what kind of reaction we get from the audience. So
now for something completely different. Gamma World is coming out later this year. I believe it is
October
for the core box. The Gamma World box is going to be it is a box set. It's not a hardbound or anything like that. The box is includes a 160 page rule book that covers character generation, how to play the game, how to GM in Gamma World, a decent selection of monsters. There's about 30 classic Gamma World monsters and a couple of new ones because we had to throw a few new ones in there. And also your first Gamma World adventure. There's a 10-encounter adventure that, you know, can get you up to about level 3 or so. So it really is a pretty good self-contained way to get started on your Gamma World game. In addition, the box includes, I think, 4 token sheets, so we'll have tokens for all the monsters that are in the adventure, plus some player character tokens, and that's the good, thick, heavy cardboard stock with, like, the almost linen-like surfacing to it, so they're pretty sturdy.
You see them they're in the role-playing game starter set right now, and they also were in some of the recent game day kits, too.
Yep. A couple of poster maps, in addition, we have a deck of 80 cards that form what we refer to as the starter deck or the GM's deck. And that deck of cards is divided into 40 mutation cards and 40 tech cards. When you create a Gamma World character, there's a lot of stuff you get to control. Depends if you roll randomly or not, I suppose. But
that's the fun
part. There's things that stay the same about your character, you know, more or less throughout your character's career. So. A character for Gamma World generally consists of a combination of two themes and mutations. And so themes and mutations might be things like android or seismic. You have seismic powers and you're kind of big and tough and rocky. Or giant, you're really big. Yeti, You're part Yeti.
Here we go with the Yeti again. You love the Yeti, don't you?
The Yeti is fun. The Yeti, by the way, was, until just a couple of weeks ago, the Ursinoid, all right? I'm a giant bear guy. And I thought about it, and I was like, I wonder if Yeti's is cooler than bear. And I actually went and conducted a survey around the office. You know, did a show of hands. Hey, guys, Ursinoid or Yeti? What do you say?
Yeti.
Yeah, Yeti won hands down. Determined that Yeti was 2.33 times as cool as Ursinoid. So, you know, that's where we wound up on. But those components of your character are pretty much what your character is. We don't necessarily use classes. It's those things about your character pretty much are your character. But in addition, you have a number of sort of random kind of over-the-top mutations, which may be good, may be bad, that are reflected by these cards. Also, your really high-tech, crazy science fiction artifacts are reflected by the Omega Tech, as we call it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you might be able to arm yourself up with an M16 or a stop sign or walk around in a bulletproof vest or maybe you come from some primitive part of the setting and you're walking around with a spear and leather armor, whatever it is. But as you find things, the really crazy things like the torque grenades and the blaster rifles and black ray pistols and powered pistol. Assault armor and things like that, those all kind of live over in the card acquisition. And so the game comes with 80 cards for the GM that include a whole selection of these things. Plus, we're also going to create a number of an entire deck of booster cards. There's a 120 card set of booster cards that'll be sold. 8 cards to a blister pack. I think the cost on that's going to be about
$3.99.
Yeah.
I think, yeah.
And with those cards, you have the opportunity to kind of customize your own deck of these special mutations and the special technology things. You don't necessarily always know that you're going to find things off of your deck instead of the GM's deck. So you might sit there and say, you know, I know I got disintegrating touch in my personal deck that I brought. But as it turns out, this time I have to draw from the GM's deck, and I wanted disintegrating touch, and I got big flappy feet. You know, if surviving the scenario absolutely depends on you not taking a difficult terrain penalty for running around in mud or snow, the big flappy feet will save your life. But it is true; it might be a bit of a narrow power.
But you could do crazy things like that when you have the GM deck and the player's decks, right?
Absolutely. That's the core rule set for Gamma World. We're also going to do another two adventures/expansions that follow after that. First one is Famine at Fargo, which sort of reprises the classic Gamma World adventure that involved the dreaded Gallus Gallus 13, which was actually a giant mutated one-eyed chicken with a bad attitude. The expansion has pretty much the same stuff that the starter set has, but it only has 10 cards included with the expansion. We have another expansion coming up early in 2011. Because it's in 2011, I don't think I can say what the name of it is yet. But we are hard at work at that right now. And what else do I need to
tell you? Are the expansions, and the main game is in a box set, right?
Yes, the expansions are in a box.
And the expansions are also boxes.
And have more adventure content than the base game. Because in the base game, we had to obviously spell out the basic, spell out the rules. And we do expect that, you know, probably 90% of the people who pick up this game and play it will be folks who are very familiar with D&D. But we still have to kind of go include the starter rules about as what you would see like in the D&D starter set as far as things like this is what armor class is, this is what reflex defense is, this is how you take your turn, all that sort of stuff. And by the way, I do want to mention, the game is very compatible with D&D. For the first time in Gamma World's history, you can actually play D&D and Gamma World pretty much interchangeably. There are a couple little tiny adjustments here and there, like the skill list is a little bit different. But like you could drop D&D monsters in your Gamma World game, they'll work just fine. You could drop Gamma World monsters in your D&D game, and they'll work just fine. The artifacts will be kind of spooky and scary in the D&D game, but
Black Ray Pistol,
it's built on the same chassis of like how a D&D power is described, you know. So you know, here's the fusion rifle. It's going to be like a plus 17 attack that does 6d10 radiation damage. Not many D&D monsters have resist radiation.
They might mutate.
Yeah.
I could see a D&D game where you use the mutation deck as like, okay, this is an area, like for example, Forgotten Realms, right? The area of the spell plague, right?
You could
use that as sort of like, oh, you get a temporary mutation while you're in this area, right? Or something. Yeah, it'd be fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
And actually a question for R&D regarding their first experiences with the original Gamma World.
I got it. The one I picked up was the old Greytone box that had Ruined City and the guy with the...
artwork.
Yeah. It's kind of funny. Our boss, Bruce Cordell and I co-wrote the first box. Rob Schwab, who's actually lurking in the back of the room there, did Famine at Fargo. And we're kind of comparing notes a little bit and or like, you know, when I played this game as like a 14, 15-year-old kid, man, I kind of played it straight up, right? You know, I didn't play it as a total gag. You know, I was pretty serious about it. You know, it's a science fantasy world, and it doesn't necessarily have to – yeah, okay, goofy stuff can happen, right? But you know, darn it, I made up my Panther Man, you know, and I mutated Pantheroid, and he was really badass. You know, he had claws, and he had – you know, like six arms, and they were all deadly because they had natural attacks on each of them, right? And, I mean, I played it pretty seriously and intently as a kid. Bill Slavicek's recollection of the game is a bit different, right? He was like, but you walk into a radiation zone and you get new arms. That's ridiculous. You must have played that as a, you know, just as a comic thing. So there's a little bit of tension in the traditions of Gamma World between is it really trying to be a serious game or is it trying to be a little bit more humorous? We tried to basically make sure that the skeleton of the game is pretty kind of solid and straight up. I mean, the rules have a bit of a snarkier tone to them than D&D and make a few snide asides, but we tried to keep that part of it pretty straight up and let the powers and the theme combinations kind of carry a lot of the humor. I mean, because let's face it, if you're playing a Yeti cockroach, that's just funny.
Yeah.
I'm part Yeti, I'm part cockroach, and I've got a fusion rifle. Stay the hell out of my way.
Yeah. One other thing I wanted to ask you, Rich. So can you think of, like, the themes that your character has where you smash the two together?
Yeah.
And, like, the stuff you get there is kind of like your class features, and then like, the mutations and technology is more like your powers?
Yeah, well, the themes do include some powers.
Okay.
And in fact, all the themes lean towards one of the character roles.
Okay.
All right, so Yeti's a big, strong guy. He leans towards defender, right? He likes to be a melee. He's got powers that reward him for being a melee. Cockroach is kind of fast and nimble and skittery. So we lean him towards striker, right? The cockroach has a trait that just says the cockroach's power is, as a free action, after I hit you, I can spit up cockroach acid on you and do extra damage, right? Which essentially makes you very much a striker in D&D terms, because you're fast, nimble, and you do extra damage, right? If you're playing a cockroach, you're already kind of part striker, no matter what you do. Boy, something else I was going to say about that. Other thing I was going to say is part of the fun, by the way, is when you get two themes that just don't seem to go together.
And trying to figure it out.
And trying to figure it out. And watching people do that, it's really... here's an example. We have a Hawkoid theme. Right, you get to be a flying birdman. We also have the seismic theme, which is you're essentially the thing. Right, and you get those two together. Well, how the hell can I be a seismic, guy that's also a birdman?
And then
you know, we thought about it, and I realized Kieran Chase was playing that character. I was having trouble with it and then just out of the blue, like 20 minutes later, it's like, you're a gargoyle. That's what you are. You're a flying rocky guy. You're a gargoyle.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, okay. Yeah. Got it. That's cool. Now I'm on it, right? And so having those little opportunities for creative interpretation of what the heck the themes just told you is a lot of fun. In fact, the thing that it kind of kills us, we have 20 themes in the first set, and the first thing we realize after, like, you know, playtest session one is, man, we wish we had 40. So Famine of Fargo introduces a dozen more themes.
Oh, nice.
And the set after that will even get, I think, maybe like another 8 on top of that. So we're gonna promulgate those themes pretty quick because they're fun. We intend Gamma World essentially to be your change of pace campaign that a lot of people have, right? You have your regular D&D game. Maybe you have to drop out for, you know, or maybe you set it aside for a couple of months because the next guy is going to GM, but, you know, he's got to put his campaign together first. Or possibly you're playing a couple times a week and you want to do, for your second game, something that's a very different style of game. All the stuff put together in our Gamble World line will probably support about 5 to 6 months of play if you just, like, played straight through all three boxes, playing about once a week. Maybe a little bit less if you play really fast, and maybe a little bit more if you really take your time. So we don't really look at this to be, you're going to start a years-long new Gamble World campaign and never stop it, which is always sort of the secret assumption of most RPGs.
Mm-hmm.
But this is what we're saying. No, it's okay. You play Gamble World for a while, you have some fun, and then you can kind of go back to D&D, or maybe, you know, there's certainly you can build new adventures and build as much, new material as possible. And I certainly would not rule out the idea that we might have some DDI support. Well, no reason we couldn't create some Gamma World adventures and make them available. It just kind of depends depends to some extent what you guys, tell us you want.
Yeah. A question on Gamma World regarding the necessity of the booster pack additional mutation cards.
You don't have to buy the blisters packs of cards if you don't want to, right? The assumption is if you didn't bring in your own cards, you can just draw off the GM's deck, right, every time you get to draw a card. But the problem with the GM's deck is sometimes you get big flappy feet.
Or couldn't you create like a bunch of people just like pool their booster packs and like have like a central deck? So if you wanted to really kind of make it crazy, you could play
absolutely
with that, and that way. Yeah,
so
you have a couple of different options. Right. The other thing, too, speaking of options, do you want to talk a little bit about, like, you said that there's, like, a random element, too, for character creation?
Yes, we started off with the basic assumption that we wouldn't make it different from D&D unless we had a good reason to, because we want people to be able to pick us up and play it as easily as possible. And certainly the default option that we use around the office for figuring out what your character themes are is, throw 2d20s, and that's what you get. And, you know, and if you don't like it and you want to do it again, we're going to call you a wuss and make fun of you.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the spirit of Gamma World is living with what the chart tells you. So beyond that, we had that system in place, and then we, you know, in the original design, we said, okay, now we're going to do an assigned ability score thing, and we're going to let you pick your skills. And our development team looked at that right off and said, you know, rolling for the random stuff is so much fun. We just want to keep going with that. We want to roll our ability scores. We want to roll our skill choices. And
very old school then, huh?
Yeah. So you do get, you know, if a theme has a prime requisite that it really needs, like the seismic guy is, I think it might be strength or con-based, probably con-based. Right? So you're going to get the 18 con, whatever your theme is, you're going to get a good ability score for. And then whatever else you have left, you're just picking up 3d6 and rolling. So you might have con 4 if con wasn't your primary theme. And I had some problems with that at first. They had to talk me down off the cliff, the development team
Rich.
Did.
Let it go, Rich. Let it go.
And I finally, you know, consoled myself with the thought that back in the day when you rolled Gamma World characters, 33% of all mutations you rolled were defects. And included some things like brittle bones. You take double damage from all attacks. I was like, well, rolling a con 4 is kind of like that.
Right.
I guess that's where maybe the defects you're living is that sometimes a 3d6 will do very nasty things to you. And other times you'll get, well, why do I have an 18 charisma? I don't know. That's what the dice said. It has nothing whatsoever to do with anything I do. Mm-hmm. I guess I rolled like some sort of random hyper charisma mutation that I didn't know about, and there it is.
And character creation is like super fast too, right? It's like, what?
Especially because of the fact you're not actually trying to evaluate different options and compare them, and you're just living what the dice tell you, you can create your Gamma World character in like 15 minutes. Yeah. And that's if you actually take some time and really look at the weapons table, right? You know, it's like, oh, what?
Yeah.
Do I like the great axe or the katana or the tire iron? I don't know.
Yeah.
I might have to change a tire too, so maybe the tire.
It's got utility, right? You know. So no, that seems like it's going to lend itself really well to like doing organized play events too, because you can show up then, no character, no pre-gens, and everybody just rolls them up and plays with what they got and plays the adventure.
Maybe a couple of booster packs.
Yeah,
so
bring
you get
bring
get
a couple.
Rip open right there.
Show up with a couple of boosters. Use what you got.
Yeah,
and have fun. And I know that we're doing a Gamma World Game Day. And I'm pretty certain that we're going to be doing that kind of character gen element to it too, right? Where it's going to be show up, you're not going to get free gens, you're going to sit down and you're going to make characters, right?
Yep.
And everybody have fun. So.
And one more question on Gamma World regarding the generation of the different themes.
I did something very clever for this. I was bragging about this for weeks. I just couldn't believe how smart I was. So we have 20 themes, and then we had the engineered human theme sitting off to the side. It's like, well, I want you to roll D20, you know, for your theme, and then roll it again. But, you know, I've got this 21st theme. How can I get 21 results out of a D20 roll? And then it came to me that if you roll your two themes and the number comes up the same, you're an engineered human. So it's like, oh, right, you get that theme, yeah, you get that theme, and you get engineered human as your other component. So engineered human a lot of times will be things that aren't necessarily pure strain, but might work. For example, if you got the android theme and the human theme, man, clearly you're the Terminator, right? Mm-hmm. And that's pretty cool, right?
Yeah.
That's close enough that I'm going to call that a pure strain human. You look the human, you know. You're not green. You don't got tentacles or nothing, you know. You're pretty human. There's other themes that are very that are to some extent don't necessarily govern your character appearance, right? Like there's like a telekinetic theme, there's a hypercognitive theme for a guy who just sees and perceives everything, and there are other themes that clearly you would have a hard time reconciling with an engineered human.
If I'm a telekinetic guy, you know, that perceives everything, am I just a giant floating eyeball?
No reason you couldn't do that.
Another question for Gamma World regarding the cards.
The cards are essentially powers. Sometimes they're like a persistent power that you just have while it's in play. So if you draw a card like a Carapace card, right, the assumption is Carapace is going to last until the next time you change cards. The language is something like, as long as this is your readied power, right, you've got a Carapace, and you get +3 AC or whatever. Essentially, at the beginning of your adventuring day, okay, at the end of a long rest, or first time you're going to start adventuring for the day, we're all going to draw a card and see what we got, right? And sometimes you'll say, hey, I've got a great one-shot mutation that's sitting there, you know, like I've got, you know, the Gamma Eye, which is going to just fry the hell out of something with radiation. But it's essentially a one-shot attack, and when I use it, it's gone. Or you might get Carapace, which is, until I change cards again, I've got like +3 AC. And the assumption is you're probably going to change cards at the end of each encounter, at least as far as those mutations go. The tech stuff, like the science fiction tech, a lot of that tends to be fire and forget stuff also. So if you draw like the blaster pistol, right, the blaster pistol is probably only going to last for a couple of shots before it breaks. I'm not going to tell you the exact mechanic that decides that. But suffice it to say that you maybe get a shot or two, and then it breaks and it's done. But you don't necessarily lose tech you've already found when you stop for a long rest. So you might eventually accumulate a whole bunch of gear, which is
mostly
not reliable
junk at that point. Mostly junk at that point.
It
probably,
could be junk. I mean,
but
you might have, you know, you might have a black ray pistol, a grenade, you know, a shotgun, or this or that, and you'll. Obviously, until you actually expend the thing, mm-hmm. The assumption is usually, by the way, most of these things are going to be like encounter powers, right? Like on the tech, if you have the black ray pistol, it's an encounter power. So once per encounter, you can, you know, get that thing to fire off a really deadly shot. Then you're going to check and see, all right, do I have it for the next encounter, or was this its final shot? We also have a mechanic whereby sometimes you can salvage down. Really good tech and actually make it part of your character permanently, and it's not going to expend or break. But at that point, it's because you're keeping it working at a reduced level. Mm-hmm. And in essence, you don't really get like a +3 longbow in Gamma World. What you get is, you know, a salvaged down plasma rifle that just functions at a level that is about as good as a good D&D magic item, if you want to think of it that way. And a lot of the tech cards for like the GM's deck, most of those, by the way, don't necessarily persist. The assumption is that most of the GM deck stuff is going to be things that will probably only work once, and then you're just going to discard it, which is why, just like those mutations I was talking about earlier, might be very narrow or not optimal. The tech from the GM's deck is a lot of time, that'll be like rusty laser pistol, right? It's really only good for one shot, you know, but
the character progression, like the way that you play out a campaign. Do you want to talk a little bit about like how, you know, you talked about like how long you play in the terms of like time, but like what, like your leveling experience, what's that like?
We did design it to level a little bit faster than D&D, and get you to level 10, and then we stop at that point. Obviously, a fully geared up level 10 Gamma World character is probably going to be significantly tougher than a geared up level 10 D&D character, because fusion rifles are pretty righteous, right? Yeah. That's no two ways about it. But yeah, we do want there is an advancement chart. It looks a little bit like the advancement chart for like D&D characters, as far as telling you when you get to acquire different power, your powers out of your themes, and get new choices on things.
One more question on Gamma World regarding the interplay between the 4th edition mechanics and the Gamma World setting.
And I could see a new player being really interested maybe in Gamma World and learning that engine, right, and then going into D&D, right?
Right, and he would have. I mean, there'd be a couple little details.
Sure.
Like, I don't know if we're going to have, like, action points in Gamma World, for example, but, you know, that would be a pretty easy thing for someone to learn if they were going from Gamma World to D&D.
I thought only the monsters.
It's kind of funny, because right now the monsters do have them, and it's like, well, geez, what it's kind of a nuisance that the elites and the solos, we just dropped it in there kind of automatically and realized, well, now we have to explain to people what action points are. Is that really something that's worth doing just for the monsters if we didn't do it for the PCs? And I think the answer is we're probably going to wind up pulling them off the
monsters.
Pulling them off the monsters. Yeah, it's not really necessary. Plus, the monsters are we want to keep them simple.
So thanks a lot for coming to Beyond the D&D RPG seminar. We're going to be doing the Athos Unveiled seminar at 3 o'clock. So why don't we take a break here now and let these guys get set up for that. Rich Baker and Rob Schwalp will be our hosts for that seminar. Thanks again, guys.
Thanks for listening to the recording of the Beyond the RPG seminar. If you do have any more questions about any of the products that you heard, as always, feel free to check the D&D website and navigate to the product catalog page. There you should find the information that we have available, and be sure to check back for further information as it does become available. If you have any questions about the game in general, as always, drop us a line at dndinsider@wizards.com. Again, that's dndinsider@wizards.com. Thanks for listening.